to thank Fall Zeichman's LLP for their willingness to host the series. God willing, it will be in person in May, maybe. I don't know. We'll have to see. I also want to thank the Bayit and Shari Shamayim for partnering with the Beit Midrash on this program. Like with all programs, we're going to be discussing issues that are relevant for Jewish law, but in the event that you have a practical question about this, definitely speak to accountant / lawyer / rabbi in order to get guidance. Nothing that I say here should be taken as a as practical advice. This is the first in a series of three. Those who have the flyer already know what's on that list, but I will note we're actually flipping the second and third. The second session, the one listed as the second session, is actually going to be the third session. Other than that, the flyer is accurate. So our topic is managing minors, overseeing the financial affairs of children. It's a big topic. We've actually talked about bits and pieces of it over the years, but I want to do some new things today. And you can see on the sheet, I gave you, four different vignettes. I'm not going to read all of them out now. You can see them all if you want to see them there. But what I want to do overall is first talk about the contractual power of a minor, what the status is of a contract that a minor enters into in Jewish law as well as in secular law. Then talk about an issue of guardianship. And when there is a guardian for the property of a minor, number one, how do we pick a guardian? How do we choose a guardian? And how does the guardian actually run the assets of the minor? And then, if we get through all three of those, I'll answer a by-demand question that people have asked me a lot. And that's not about business ethics at all, but it is about minors and managing their affairs and the question of vaccination, where parents disagree on the vaccination of a child, someone who is already qualified to receive a vaccine, so let's say an early teen, who decides and how is that supposed to be decided? Okay, letting in additional people from the waiting room. And we're going to get underway with our first vignette. This vignette is actually built on a real case, which you'll see. I've referred to it on the source sheet later. Wired Comics and Collectibles held a special sale to clear out inventory. Sally, age 14, withdrew $4,000 in cash of her bat mitzvah money. She did well at her bat mitzvah. She withdrew it from her bank account in order to purchase discounted vintage comic books. Pronoun is wrong in that line. Her. When Sally's parents found out, they brought the comic books back to Wired Comics and Collectibles, arguing that their daughter's agreement was voidable. She was only 14. Are Sally's parents correct under civil law and Jewish law? What would you say? Who's right? Can Sally's parents... Assuming Sally's on board, let's not make this more complicated than we need to. Sally says, yeah, that was really a mistake. I regret that I did it. I wanted that $4,000 to pay for college so that my parents don't have to. She feels terrible and she regrets it. Are they right that Sally was underage and therefore they can back out of the agreement? What would you say? Nathan says voidable both under civil law and under Jewish law because Sally was a minor.
Correct. Well, I don't know if Torah distinguishes minor or not, but I distinctly remember things about doing a neder and the father can negate the neders of the daughter while she lives in his house. So I think for Jewish law, that's my rationale for saying it's voidable. And then there's civil law. I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that if they're a minor, they can contract.
So that's a very interesting argument, that Jewish law argument that you brought. Certainly from a secular perspective, a minor's inability to contract agreements is going to affect this. It's going to get a little more complicated, but that's certainly present. In terms of the Jewish law piece of it, though, quoting the law of vows as a precedent is creative, but I don't think I would apply it here. It's true that it's tied to finances in the sense that a father's right to cancel the vow that his daughter makes when she's underage and she's single is based on his financial responsibility for her. Nonetheless, it doesn't necessarily translate into general parental ability to cancel the agreements of their children. We would not go that far. So let's launch into this. First of all, bigger picture question. That's sort of a first step. Why is it that minors are not able to manage their own affairs? Why is it that we say minors cannot execute contracts? Civil law.
They'll spend it on comic books.
Right, they'll spend it on comic books, Sheldon says. We are concerned that they're going to make bad decisions. That's one argument. Other argument? So there's another way to look at it. If you take a look on the sheet at source number one, and I'm going to put the link in the chat once again, I will note for those who joined in the last couple of minutes, please make sure that you sign in via the chat. Just send me a message, especially if you want a credit letter, but also if you want to be on the email list for the business ethics classes. So if you take a look at source number one, this is an article, Unity and Pluralism in Contract Law, from the Michigan Law Review, and it presents one theory of how contracts overall work. Forget minors. How contracts work. Contract theory suffers from an embarrassment of riches. Roughly speaking, there are two main camps, one of which contains two significant subcamps. On one side sit the economic theories, which not surprisingly argue that contract law should be guided by notions of efficiency, welfare maximization. On the other side sit what Stephen Smith labels right-based theories, and that's what I'm focusing on here. That's why I bolded it. The idea that a person is able to enter into a contract because human beings have rights, and one right is that your word should be recognized. That's one way to look at how contracts work overall. You are a human being. You have the right to be able to enter into a contract. As opposed to source number two, contract as promise, which argues instead the regime of contract law, which respects the dispositions individuals make of their rights, carries to its natural conclusion the liberal premise that individuals have rights, and the will theory of contract, which sees contractual obligations as essentially self-imposed, is a fair implication of liberal individualism. I'm not going into the jargon, I'm not going into the philosophy, I'm just borrowing that key phrase, that it is self-imposed, meaning that the goal of creating a system of contracts is in order to empower people to enter into agreements of their own choosing. It's a utilitarian perspective. Society won't be able to function unless people are able to create agreements. Two different approaches. There's a utilitarian approach. We need to have agreements. And then you have the rights-based approach, which is you have a right to have your word recognized in an agreement. Interestingly, then, you have two different approaches to why we exclude minors. One approach to excluding minors is the utilitarian approach. Just like we have contracts, we have agreements as a means of achieving a goal, for society to create agreements. Well, it's from a utilitarian perspective, it's bad to enable minors to enter into agreements. Because if you enable minors to enter into agreements, they're going to make bad agreements. They're going to spend their bat mitzvah money on comic books. That's the utilitarian approach. The rights-based approach says no. The child is not yet a full human being such that they even have rights. You can make either argument, and both arguments are made. And what I find interesting about that is that you find both concerns in Jewish law as well. I brought you in source number three from Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman, who was a major authority in Jewish law. and Rosh Yeshiva in the period pre-war. He was murdered by the Nazis. If you take a look at source number 3, he says, and I'm reading out in general my English translations as opposed to the original Hebrew, but you can see the Hebrew there. He said, there are two issues regarding a minor. One, a minor who has not achieved capacity is mentally incompetent. That's one problem with having a minor make agreements, enter into contracts, is that the minor doesn't have that level of function that's needed. That's the utilitarian perspective. He's going to make bad decisions. And then second, a bright minor, whom we perceive to have the mind of an adult, but the deeds of a minor are nothing by scriptural fiat. Even if this minor seems like an adult, seems mature, nonetheless, biblical text says, in describing contracts, ki yitain ish, when a man gives, not a minor. A minor's deed lacks the force to effectuate transaction or marriage. In other words, it's not about making bad decisions. It's about the fact that a minor isn't a full person in the eyes of Jewish law. The minor cannot effectuate transaction or marriage. You follow what I'm saying? Is this at all clear? I had a lot of noise in the background because I'm in a high school and it was just lunch break, the end of lunch. Hopefully this was clear. Again, what we're trying to say is that you need to be an adult in order to enter into an agreement. Number one, because we don't trust minors to do it properly. And number two, because you're not an adult, you don't have the right. You're not a full person at this stage.
So, Rabbi, by Jewish law, does one become an adult at the age of bar mitzvah, and bar mitzvah when you're responsible for your own mitzvah?
So that's a great question. And in fact, I see Sheldon wrote in the chat, Sally, in our case, is not a minor. She's already bat mitzvah. So we're going to have to talk about that. We'll talk about it, first of all, in this case, shortly. And then we're also, if we get to the vaccine case at the end, talk about it in terms of healthcare, where we actually have different standards to define who is a minor and who is an adult. So it's going to be a little complicated, and the answer will not necessarily be bar bat mitzvah for the purpose of this conversation. So it's a good question. We'll see. I saw another hand, but I don't remember where.
Would Jewish law have to take a back seat to common law because of Pita de Malchusa?
So the answer is yes and no. Meaning the question of what David is asking is, we have a principle, the law of the land is binding. The law established by the empire, so to speak, that's, the original context for it, is binding. However, one question will be, if two Jews enter an agreement with each other, are they necessarily agreeing that they're going to be governed by whatever society does, or do we assume that their intention was Torah law? When you're dealing with individuals engaging in contracts, a lot of it is about mindset. So that's gonna matter here. There's more to be said. Yeah, I'm gonna hold off on that. It's a good question that really deserves to be explored more, but I won't get to where I need to go if I follow that rabbit hole. So I'm gonna hold off on that. Miriam.
Is walking into a retail store and purchasing something entering into a contract?
So I believe the answer is yes. In the eyes of the law, that is called a contract. Yeah.
I mean, nobody can buy anything if she's underage.
So that's exactly right. That's what we're saying, is that if a minor is not able to enter into a contract, a minor is not, well, let me phrase it the way the law phrases it. Not that no one can buy anything if they're underage, but the agreement they enter into, the contract they enter into, is voidable. It can be reversed. And that's what we're dealing with here. I see the note in the chat from Mendy. If she's being supported by her parents, she's still a minor? For certain issues, yes. Not necessarily here. Let's see the sources. Today, in a secular system, in Ontario, the age of majority is 18. Ontario has an Age of Majority and Accountability Act, and the age is 18. But in addition to that, you also require comprehension. That's important as well. And comprehension has different standards for different purposes. I brought you as an example from David Truman's Assessment of Older Adults with Diminished Capacity, a handbook for lawyers, where he talks about making a gift and how there is what's called donative capacity. You have to have an understanding of the nature and purpose of the gift, of the nature and extent of the property to be given, of the natural objects of the donor's value. Like, there's a lot you have to understand in order to be trusted to make a gift. And then you have contractual capacity. This I'll read out from number 4. In determining an individual's capacity to execute a contract, courts generally assess the party's ability to understand the nature and effect of the act and the business being transacted. Accordingly, if the act of business being transacted is highly complicated, a higher level of understanding may be needed. Right? This came up several years ago. I did a program with B'nai B'rith for lawyers and accountants, and we talked about a woman who had entered into a marriage, and one of the key questions was whether she actually understood what she was doing and met the standard for capacity for marriage. From a secular perspective, you need capacity, comprehension, and you need age. From a Jewish law perspective, it looks looser. And here I come back to the question of what the age is in Jewish law. Take a look at source number 5, please. It begins on one side and then runs over onto the next. But I'm reading out my English translation, which is on the next side. Mishnah, core text of the Talmud, giving us basic law. The purchase and sale of movable items by what are called pi'utot are binding. Pi'utot refers to children who are not yet adults. They are still minors. But it isn't clear what pi'utot actually means. When you say purchase and sale of movable items by pi'utot, what does that mean? So the Gemara, commenting on that Mishnah, asks, how young? What exactly is this age that you refer to as pi'utot? So Rav Yehuda, one of the sages, points to his son, Rav Yitzchak, who wasn't Rav Yitzchak then, he was just Yitzchak at that point, and he says, 6 or 7 years old. He says, 6 or 7 years old. At that age, you could already enter into an agreement for movable items. Rav Kahana disagreed. He said, 7 or 8 years old. I want a little bit older. We have another text, a Breita, or sources that were contemporary with the Mishnah, but not canonized in the Mishnah for various reasons. And this Breita says 9 or 10 years old, but then it concludes the debate by saying, there really is no debate between these views. One says 6 or 7, one says 7 or 8, one says 9 or 10. Each depends on the child's sharpness. What we really care about, according to this passage, is not age, but rather demonstration of comprehension, demonstration of capacity. So if I stop there, I see you, Miriam, hang on. If I stop there, it sounds like Jewish law and the secular system are operating differently. It sounds like the secular system wants comprehension plus age, and Jewish law here, notwithstanding Rabbi Hanan Wasserman's comment from before, only cares about, do you understand what you're doing? And that's all we care about. So I skipped the last line in source number 5. We're going to come back to it, and that's going to change our perspective. But that's where we are right now. Miriam and then Rose.
Would gender have any part in Judaism? I would imagine in secular law it would have absolutely no part. But, you know, we see so many references that women can't be witnesses and this and that, which may have some implication on their...
Right. So no, here there's no difference. There is no difference in this regard. Rose.
The question is, how do you define intelligence? Do you have, and there are people who are mentally not mm-hmm. completely disabled, but their IQ, I mean, what do you have to do a measure
right.
assess that? That is not so black
so what we're right. So what we're requiring here is capacity to understand what it is that you're doing. The impact of what you are doing. So you need to know what you're transacting, what you're receiving. That's what we're going to require. However, I'm going to tell you now. Yeah, sorry.
Is there a cooling off period though? Like, so, you know, in your example, she regretted her actions, and I'm sure she, the daughter understood what she was doing, and she's capable of understanding.
Right.
But she was maybe a little impetuous, and now there's, you know, a regret that sets in afterwards, after it's been discussed with her parents. Is there a cooling off period that's allowed under Jewish law as well?
Right. So the answer is that there is no cooling off period in Jewish law. Your cooling off period was before you entered the agreement. Not after. I got a message in the chat. What about if the contract was for a consumable like ice cream? Given that this would not be returnable, can that translate to non-consumables? So we're not going to make a distinction based on consumables and non-consumables, but it will become a factor in the legal decision with the comic books. So maybe we'll come back to that point. But what I want to show you is that actually both secular law, which we've seen, and the Jewish law that we saw in source number 5 are on the same page. They're not disagreeing. Take a look, please, at source number 6, and then we're going to come back to number 5. Source number 6 is Ontario's Sale of Goods Act. Capacity to buy and sell is regulated by the general law concerning capacity to contract and to transfer and acquire property. Generally speaking, all the rules of contract are going to depend on capacity. However, but where necessaries are sold and delivered to a minor or to a person who by reason of mental incapacity or drunkenness is incompetent to contract, he or she shall pay a reasonable price therefore. Okay, in the event that you sell a minor what are called necessaries, and right now we have not defined what necessaries are. I'm just going to mute people because I'm hearing background noise. Where if it's an item that is a necessary item, then they have to pay for it on some reasonable level. What are necessaries? Next item here in the Sale of Goods Act. In this section, necessaries means goods suitable to the conditions in life of the minor or other person and to his or her actual requirements at the time of the sale and delivery. That's our definition of necessaries. Notice sale and delivery. So it has to be that at the time of the sale, they already needed it and they still need it at the time of the delivery. That's what we're talking about. Paul asks a question in the chat. Would the seller need to determine the understanding level of the purchaser to know whether the sale would be voidable? How much of the onus is on the seller? So we're going to come back to that question. It's a good one. But what we see here in secular law is a statement that, notwithstanding what we said before about needing to have capacity and age, in the event that what you're being sold is a necessary item, we throw capacity and age out the window. Why is that, logically? What's the reason for that? Why do we have such a rule?
You don't want to deprive the minor of acquiring the necessities of life.
Right. The minor has to have the ability to get food. What happens if they don't have an adult to provide it for them and now they can't buy things? Like, where's that going to go? So therefore, we assign the minor this right. And that's what's going on in Jewish law as well. If you go back to source number 5, in which we were told that as long as the kid is sharp, the purchase works, look at the last line, which asks, why is this valid? Why does this work? And if you're reading the Hebrew, you have the name there. For some reason, I forgot to translate it. But Rabbi Abba Bar Yaakov quotes Rabbi Yochanan saying, for the sake of his life, we allow minors to transact with movable items for the sake of the minor's life. Now, the difference between Jewish law and secular law on this is still stark, in the sense that secular law said only for necessaries. Jewish law here did not say anything about necessaries. First of all, take a look at source number 7, which presents the logic behind the Jewish law. Rabbi Yeshua Falk, the Sma, commentary to the Code of Jewish Law. He says if you didn't allow this purchase, no one would have any involvement with him. No one would have anything to do with him contractually. He could recant at will, or his family could cancel his deeds. So therefore, we say that that he is empowered to enter into a contract, and the contract is binding. But then he continues. He says, if one sells more than is needed for the sake of his life, what if the miner engaged in sale of movable items that are not necessaries, either because of quantity, right? It's one thing to say, I need to buy bread so I can eat bread today. It's another thing if he decides to buy 3 dozen rolls, which are going to go bad before he's ever going to eat them. So nonetheless, it is debated, and he quotes the authority of the Rabbi Mordechai ben Hillel, who sided with Ramban Nachmanides, that once they enacted license for minors to engage in contracts, they did not distinguish one may sell more than is needed for his life. It can go beyond. Anytime you're talking about a movable item, I stress movable item, it doesn't work for land. Land is different. According to Rabbi Falk in source number 8, the reason why land is different is because, as I have there, land requires greater sharpness and expertise in commerce than movables do. It's one thing to say a sharp kid can transact with movable items. He basically understands what milk is. It's another thing to expect him to deal in real estate. So there we draw the line. So we have a limitation on what minors are able to do in terms of entering into contracts such that their agreements are not binding. However, in secular law that's waived for necessities, which clearly Sally thought the comic books were, and in Jewish law, all movable items are subject to transaction by minors. As a side note, I'll give you a side note and then I'll take comments. As a side note, there's another difference between Jewish law and civil law regarding minors and receiving gifts. In modern civil law, it seems that any minor can acquire a gift. I'm not talking now about bequests. That's not what I'm dealing with. But if I see a kid and I decide I want to give the kid a present, I can give the kid a present. And I can't come back later and say, wait a minute, it was a minor, I want to take that back. You give the kid a gift, it is irreversible. However, historically that wasn't true for civil law. When you go back to Roman times, it wasn't so. I brought it for you in source number 9, but I'm not going to read it out. It's just an interesting point. In Roman law, a child who was under the age of 7 could not receive a gift. The person who gave the child the gift could claim it back. And between the age of 7 and then early teens, the child could acquire a gift but couldn't be held liable for any consequences that resulted from the gift. In Jewish law, a minor can acquire a gift once the minor demonstrates understanding, but only if someone is actually selling or giving the item to the minor. It's what's called in Hebrew a makneh. Otherwise that's not true. Otherwise it doesn't work. If you take a look at source number 10, you see distinctions here with different kinds of minors. It depends on his level of discernment. If he understands that rocks are not worth anything, but nuts are worth something, then he can acquire something. And the practical application of this is the following scenario. I see your hand, Moshe. The following will be a practical application of this. What if a miner finds something on the street, and then I walk up to the miner and I grab it from the miner? Is that called theft? No one gave the item to the miner. The miner just found it. And I'm assuming there are no identifiers. You're not giving it back to the original owner. Take that out of the picture. So according to what we're saying here, The miner is not able to acquire it. Rabbinically, we say, nonetheless, you're not allowed to take things from minors. We don't want you doing that. It's a bad idea. But biblically, the miner didn't acquire it at all, because the miner is a miner. You follow what I'm saying? I'm doing this a little bit quickly, because it's not really our main point. I'm just trying to show you that not only is entering into contracts an issue for minors, but even receiving gifts from a Jewish law perspective is an issue, although not within civil law. Moshe, you were going to say?
When a father gives a son a lulav and esrog.
Yeah.
Right. And would that fall under this jurisdiction or not?
It does. So Moshe points out, we have a rule that in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Arba Minim, Lulav, Etrog, and so on the first day of Sukkot, you have to own the Lulav and Etrog that you use. The Torah says, you shall take for yourself on the first day. So it has to be yours. So the question arises, often you have a family which buys one set of Lulav and Etrog. So how do the different members of the family actually use it? And if you'll tell me that the parent uses the Lulav and Etrog and then gives it to the minor, right, gives it to the child to use, does the child acquire it to be able to use it, and then how does the parent get it back? So the normal approach is to give a conditional gift. This gift to you is valid only if you give it back to me after some period of time or after you've used it. That's the normal way to deal with it. It's a valid gift, conditional on its return. However, in the event that you give it to the child without such a condition, it now belongs to the child, because we've said children are able to accept as long as there is somebody giving it to them. So therefore they acquire it, and they can't give it back to you. So you better have used the Lulav and Etrog before you gave it to them. That's the moral of the story, or create a condition. Miriam, and then Eldon.
When you're making the distinction between movable and immovable items, what about things like stocks and bonds? Are they considered movable? Because, or are they really, like, how, and you would think that they would be things that were beyond the mental acuity of a child.
Right. So it's a good question. I'd want to look into it. We've discussed in other sessions the difference between the way Jewish law looks at abstractions and stocks and bonds very much, you know, being a part of that, because the physical item that you're holding isn't the stock or bond. So I'd want to look into that. I don't know. If I get a chance before I send out the follow-up email after the class, I'll include it in that email. It's a good question. Eldon and then Paul. You're muted, Dom. Yeah.
Two quickies. The Lulav and Etrog.
Yeah.
Even if your child is post-bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
And you're going to end up paying for the Lulav and Etrog for your growing semi-growing children.
Right. If you buy a Lulav and Etrog for your child, then you're actually supposed, and it's supposed to be like that they're going to use for their mitzvah, then you're supposed to give it to them. Like, make it theirs.
Okay, no, but as you had said, take your lulav, the first bet,
yeah,
the lulav and etrog should be yours, but you can gift.
You can gift it, and that'll be theirs. Way. Yeah, that works.
And then the second question, which I don't remember now, so we'll carry on.
Okay, I'm two for two. Yes, Paul.
I don't think this is going to be Eldon's question, but I'll ask it anyway. We were distinguishing between necessities and non-necessities. I'm wondering, in our case here, are the comics purely frivolous, or are they potentially investments? And it's kind of Miriam's question about, I mean, if the person, the Sheila, whatever her name was, knew that these comics could be worth more in the future, maybe she had a lot of knowledge about it, and it wasn't just
So I refer you to source number 13. Good question. What exactly is a necessity, and could you consider investments part of that? So source number 13 is from that decision about the comic book case in 1995. This happened in Alberta. The precedents that they bring for the decision are Alberta precedents, so I can't say 100% that this applies in Ontario, although I think it's consistent. So you see the case. I brought you paragraph 1 of the decision first. The plaintiff, who sues by his next friend, because the plaintiff is the child, so somebody else is standing in for the plaintiff. During the period September 1 to October 21, 1993, purchased vintage comic books for the sum of $4,000 and change from the defendant, that's the comic book store, who at the time carried on business of buying and selling sports cards and comic books in the town of Cochrane, Alberta, under firm name of True Legends Sport Cards and Comics. The plaintiff, who was 14 years of age at the time of the acquisitions, 15 years of age at the time of trial, now sues for recovery of $4,000, the limit of the monetary jurisdiction of this court. In other words, they wouldn't be claiming $4,233, but the max the court can give is $4,000, so that's what they're suing for. So the first point in their decision, in number 6, says, The defendant concedes that comic books are not necessaries within the meaning of subsection 3 above, which I added in brackets, goods suitable to the condition in life of the minor or other person and to his actual requirements. Comic books don't fit that definition. The it happens to be, I didn't actually bring it here, but they note in presenting the case that this minor, Sally in our case, was an experienced collector who was doing this as investment. They thought of it as investment. So apparently that doesn't turn it into a necessary for the purposes of the law. So their first point is this is not called a necessary. So therefore the agreement should be voidable. But then they continue. Here the infant received, infant is just a technical term, don't get hung up on the 14-year-old infant. Here the infant received what he bargained for. There is no suggestion that the comic books were purchased at an exorbitant price. On the contrary, they were purchased at various discounts, and evidence was given by the plaintiff's next friend that many of the comic books had gone up in value according to certain trade magazines, which were never filed in evidence. I have no doubt, however, that over time this will likely occur. So it was purchased at a discount, and that's why I, in my vignette, said that it was, you know, a sale, was a clearance sale that was going on. And it's going to go up in value. These statements were made to support the plaintiff's position that despite the sale of several of the comic books, the defendant could be restored to his original position. The reason why that was brought in was because the plaintiff, the kid who bought the comic books, argued, I've actually sold off some of the comic books that I bought, but the rest of them have increased in value and therefore, you know, could still be returned to the store, and the store should take them back because they're now worth what I originally bought. Is anyone following the nuances of the case here? The kid is saying, I don't actually have all the comic books I bought off of you, but if I give you back the ones I still have, they're still worth as much as what I bought in the first place because they've gone up in value. So the court...
So she wanted to send fewer books back than she bought for the same...
Correct. Correct.
Oh, gosh.
But the point is, if you look at the end of paragraph 14, if that is the case, then it can also be said the plaintiff has in fact received a real benefit from those comic books which were sold. You got a benefit from it. Your comics went up in value. You sold off some of them. That's one point. Second point I'm going to jump down to 16. In 15, it makes the point also about how there's an added benefit because you completed a set with these comic books, but I'm jumping from that. Number 16. As a result, I find that overall the plaintiff did receive some real benefit from the contract and is not in a position to restore the defendant to his former position. You can't really give back everything to the store owner. And continues to say, in so finding, as a result, I find that overall the plaintiff did receive some real benefit from the contract and is not in a position to restore the defendant to his former position. You got benefit. You can't reverse the deal. And therefore, the ruling is that this contract is not voidable. You're not getting your $4,000. That's just too bad. Now, go back to Paul's question. Does that mean that the store owner, I think it was Paul's question, does that mean that the store owner has to put in the effort to actually find out whether the person buying has capacity? Look at number 17. In finding that the contract is not voided, this does not mean that I condone the actions of the defendant. It is true that I'm being informed by his employee early on in the transactions, because there were multiple, of the plaintiff's expenditures, the defendant on the whole being an absentee owner. He made inquiries as to the financial responsibility of the plaintiff's parents, but never attempted to contact either parent direct in respect of what had to be unusually sizable transactions over a short period of time by a 14-year-old boy, despite the fact he and they resided in a rather small community. In other words, you got away with one, Wired Comics and Collectibles. You shouldn't really be able to get away with this. You should have really done the research, and you didn't. You're going to win the case, but this isn't a good way for you to be conducting business. That's the secular law. Whereas in halacha, in Jewish law, the answer is the deal is done. These are movables. We don't care if they're necessities or not. It doesn't make a difference. They're movables. The miner is old enough to comprehend. It's a deal. That's the way it works. You don't like it? Don't give the kid the keys to the bank account. That's the way it works. So that's the that's vignette number one. Somebody made the register that they'd like us to move along. So we're going to do what we can with that. Yes, Eldon, before I move along.
Sure. My question was, when you were talking about gifting, if you give a gift to your grandkid for his birthday.
Yeah.
You know.
So from secular law, from a secular law perspective, it is entirely binding. And if your it's binding. If your grandkid's sibling takes it away, they're stealing. From a Jewish law perspective, also, as long as the grandkid is old enough to comprehend what gifts are, you gave it to the kid, so there's somebody transferring it to the child, therefore it works.
More specifically, my question, your 2-year-old grandkid.
Right, so then no, it's not binding. If you want to take it back, you actually could, although rabbinically we don't like taking things from children. Okay. So let's talk about how you manage the affairs of minors. There's a lot to be said, but we're going to fit it in. I'll also note that our topic next week from Rabbi Anstandig is going to relate to guardianship also in certain ways, so some of that may overlap. I'm going to note now, because not everybody here was already in the session when I announced it before, if you haven't yet signed in with a message to me in the chat, please make sure to do so. Thank you. Okay, especially if you want a letter certifying that you were here. In terms of how the guardianship works, there's a basic difference between the civil institution of guardianship and the Jewish institution of guardianship. In civil law, guardianship is a court-appointed position where applicants file plans for managing the assets, and the child chooses the guardian. The court chooses the guardian. The court is the one that's going to make that choice. In Jewish law, it is actually a mitzvah to serve as a guardian. It's a religious duty. The family, relatives of the child can make the arrangement. If they don't, then the rabbinical court will make the arrangement. The mitzvah involved is what's called in the Torah, v'hashevo solo, or hashavas aveda, restoring lost property. Meaning, you have a responsibility. If somebody loses something and you find it, and you have the ability to give it back, you have a responsibility to do so. You are doing that on behalf of the child here. And that mitzvah is what empowers the guardian to administer the person's property for the child's own good. Otherwise, for me to do it is called theft. I'm taking his stuff and giving it away. If you take a look at source number 12, you see one passage in the Talmud that talks about this, talking about the case of an adult who became a shotet, became so irrational they were considered mentally incompetent. When a man becomes a shotet, and it isn't man-specific, going back to your question before, Miriam, it just happens to be that that's what it says. When a man becomes a shoteh, the court descends into his assets to feed and support his wife and children, and for another matter, the court will make sure that the children are getting fed, are getting supported, the wife is getting fed, getting supported, and also the court can do something else. What does that mean? What is this something else? What is another matter that the court is dealing with? So Rav Chisda said jewelry. To buy jewelry for his wife. The court will assign a guardian to buy jewelry on behalf of the wife of this person who is not sane. Rabbi Yosef said, tzedakah, meaning the court will actually give charitable gifts from this person's assets. And then there's a discussion whether everybody will agree regarding the tzedakah, whether everybody will agree regarding the jewelry, but that's one source that supports this idea of guardianship. Another one is in source number 15, the Talmud and Kiddushin. There are many more that I could bring to this effect. So let's look at vignette number 2. Okay, take a look at vignette number 2, and let's see how this plays out. William, an accountant specializing in cross-border tax filings, is appointed as guardian for the property of 5-year-old Samantha. The property includes a trust of $10,000 from Samantha's deceased grandmother. When the guardianship began, the trust was invested in municipal bonds. Nice, safe. But William has been reading a lot about cryptocurrency and believes it will be worthwhile to diversify the portfolio by putting $3,000 in Ethereum. May William buy cryptocurrency on behalf of Samantha? I heard a yes, but I can't see where it came from. Who said yes? Okay, Moshe says yes. Why, Moshe? Well, he's not knowledgeable in that field, at least not professionally so. He's been reading about it. But his professional credentials are in cross-border taxation. So, if you take a look at number 16, as a general principle, guardianship is supposed to be best interests of the child. That's true across the board, not just in financials. The child does not really have an opinion recognized in law. It's not like you're saying, I'm going to do what the child wants. You're doing what you think is good for the child. And if you look at what I brought you in number 16, this is Rule 212 from the CPA Code of Professional Conduct, handling of trust funds and other property. A member or a firm that receiving, handling, or holding money or other property in any capacity, as a trustee or as a receiver or receiver manager, guardian, that's the key one for us, administrator, manager, or liquidator shall do so in accordance with the terms of the engagement, including the terms of any applicable trust and the law relating thereto, and shall maintain such records, ... And in 212.2, handling property of others, a member or firm in the course of providing professional services shall handle with due care any entrusted property. So the guidance on that says, while it may be prudent to obtain legal advice with respect to complying with the law relating to trusts, the following should assist in understanding the rule. Each trust relationship should be documented in writing. And that's a principle overall. You have to be, you have to do it in writing. It's just smart. But my point here is that you don't get a whole lot of specifics. Do it in a way that is professional. Do it in a way that is prudent. I mean, Moshe says cryptocurrency is like any other investment. If that's true, then you're covered, right? That's really what you you need to do. No one can come across later and challenge you for it. This is what I believe was best interest of the child. It was noted in the chat that cryptocurrencies help avoid taxes. I'm assuming this is being done above board. I'm not assuming that we're dealing with criminal conduct. I think it's just somebody who thought this is a good way to invest the kid's money. That's really all it comes down to. Miriam, I'm actually going to forego the question right now, Paul also, just because it's already 1:22, and I want to get through vignettes 2 and 3. I knew 4 was unlikely, but at least 2 and 3. So Jewish law, on the other hand, is very detailed about this. Secular law, very open-ended. Jewish law is really specific about what it wants. It wants best interest of the child. So, for example, I brought you in source number 17, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says that the guardian gives tzedakah from the assets of the child, and the reason is, if you look at the end of the English in number 17, so that they will develop a good reputation. The point of it is, this is the best interest of the child. Meaning, if you have somebody who is known in the community as not supporting community needs, right? If they say, I'm not giving to the synagogue, I'm not giving to the mikvah, I'm not giving to the tomchei shabbat, whatever it is, then people say, well, they're not a serious person, they're not a serious player in the community. If they become known as supporters, it will help them. So this is their best interest. With adults, we also have a substituted judgment concept, but that's a different story and not relevant here. So my goal here is to do best interest, just like in secular law. However, In Jewish law, it's very conservative. Because the mitzvah of guardianship comes from restoring lost property, right? Hashavas Aveda. The goal is just keep the child from losing their assets, not try what you can to make money. The point is avoid having them lose money. So that if you take a look at source number 19, Rabbi Yeshaya Blau, a major authority in Jewish law, he was a judge on a rabbinical court, and he wrote the book, literally, on financial issues in Israel, passed away about 5 or 6 years ago. He quotes an authority, the Knesset HaGedolah, who wrote, "It is obvious that if he, the guardian, does not find an opportunity to profit without fear of loss, it will be better that he not invest." Don't invest. That's the way it goes. That's the way that this works. Someone sent me a message in the chat. Yes, I'm recording audio, just not video. Don't worry. Rabbi Blau's answer is that you don't invest if all you have are risky investments. Now, you have to evaluate what is considered risky. No surprise. But that's the way that this works in Jewish law, is that the power of the guardian is primarily a conservative power, not an aggressive one. Vignette number 3. The question of whom we have serve as a guardian. So go back to the vignettes for a moment. Tragically, Julie and David die in an automobile accident, leaving behind their 12-year-old son, Raymond. Two people step forward to apply to serve as guardians for property. Rhonda, the family accountant, and Julie's brother, James, Uncle James, a librarian. Whom should the court choose as guardian under civil law and Jewish law? Do you take the uncle, or do you take the accountant? So, from a secular perspective, we care about what the kid wants, but the best interest of the child is going to hold sway. If you take a look at source number 20 from the Children's Law Reform Act, in deciding an application for the appointment of a guardian of the property of a child, the court shall consider all the circumstances, including ability of the applicant to manage the property of the child, merits of the plan proposed by the applicant for the care and management of the property of the child, and the views and preferences of the child, where such views and preferences can reasonably be ascertained. So the kid says, I want my uncle, I forget if it was uncle or aunt, but there's also an accountant. We're going to take the accountant, not the librarian. With due respect to librarians, they're very smart. But that's what we're going to do, with the person who has professional experience. From a Jewish law perspective, it's all about best interest of the child. The child does not have an opinion in this regard. If you take a look at source number 21 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, what do we look for? A trustworthy person of substance who knows how to lobby for the benefit of the orphans, makes their claims, has a strong business position so that he will protect and increase their assets. We want business acumen. We want business influence. We also want someone who is a careful spender. If you take a look at source number 22, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, if he squanders the assets of the orphans, we remove him. That's what the Code of Jewish Law says. But he goes on to say, it specifically writes the assets of the orphans. What if he squanders his own assets? He's somebody who's a big spender with his own property. Then we don't remove him. We may assume he's careful with the property of the orphans, you know, just not with his own. He's willing to be careful that way. So on this, Rabbi Blau writes, this all refers to, I'm saying this quickly, but I hope it's still clear. He says, this refers to this careful spending discussion, refers to where he's already a guardian, and then we start to see irresponsible behavior. That's, in a case like that, that's where we say, let's not remove him, we'll keep him in place. However, if we see that he's irresponsible beforehand, then we aren't going to appoint him. Somebody who is not known as a careful spender for himself is not trusted as a guardian. We would not choose that person as a guardian. That's right, Blau, based on source number 22. There are more requirements also in the Code of Jewish Law, but I brought the ones that I thought were directly relevant for the discussion here. So to summarize what we had today, number one, we learned the secular theories behind the power of contracts. Utilitarian, this enables people to do business. rights-based. You're a member of society, you have the right to enter into agreements and have your word honored. However, and Jewish law we saw was the same, and the minor could be disqualified either because from a utilitarian perspective the minor makes bad decisions, or because the minor is not a person until the minor achieves the age. However, we said in practice, secular law says you could still do necessities. Jewish law says movable items. As long as you understand what you're doing, even if you're a minor, you're still able to do, to engage in the transaction. And hence, in the comic book case, Jewish law will say the transaction is binding. Secular law will say, well, this isn't a necessity. But then they add in that in the event that the, that you received a benefit, you were not cheated, you bought them at a discounted price even, then it's binding. You were not cheated, that's good enough. That's the logic in the secular agreement. We said that the Jewish law wants the guardian to be conservative in investments. Secular law leaves it, civil law leaves it very broad in terms of what they can do. And in terms of who we choose for the best interests of the child. In civil law, we just say best interests hold sway, although we list the child's desire as a factor. And in Jewish law, we don't even list the child's desire as a factor in selecting who the guardian ought to be. There's a question in the chat, can a Jewish guardian take a fee for services? The answer is yes, within reason. There's a lot of law on this as to what qualifies as within reason. But yes, there is an ability to take a fee for services. It's actually a fun discussion because, well, it's a mitzvah you're doing. You shouldn't take fees for a mitzvah. But that's beyond the scope of where we're going to go right now. Thank you very much, everyone. I'll note once again, we have two more sessions coming up. I'm going to resend the flyer when I send out the follow-up email. So that will also include, it will include the link to the recording. It'll include the flyer for the next two sessions. And I hope you'll be here, and I hope you'll enjoy. Thank you very much. Credit letters go out at the end of the series. I'll stick around for some questions for a few minutes. Thank you very much. Yes, Eldon.
Hi, Rabbi.